We are back here, and we've had experiences since the last time we recorded.
Experience.
Yes, experiences.
I've become a man.
Today's Mike, you are a man.
I feel like you dropped me off at the whorehouse and made me get blown by some old Trixie named Candy, and I'm all grown up.
You're all grown up now.
But all we did was really talk.
It'll take you 15 years to get over the trauma.
But so we're talking about that. We went to the science fiction convention in Dappletown called Convergence.
Convergence. This is the first time I have been to a sort of a fan convention like this, and same
well.
For you. And we were a little nervous going, I at least had, if not a blast, at least like a nice big poof.
I had what would be called as an okay experience.
You were having an anthropological blast.
Yeah, anthropologically, yes.
So was I,
but I wasn't personally like, wow, I can't wait to do this again.
I have to make nachos.
It wasn't as good as that.
No. There was it was one of those conventions where there's lots of people in costume dressed as anime characters.
But not a lot. Not as many as I thought.
Not a lot, but your eyes, when somebody walked by, that's where your eyes went. If you actually sat down and looked at people as they walked by, what you saw were a lot of black t-shirts and ponytails. A lot of dumpy people, nerds. A lot of nerds.
A group of the palest people I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know.
The hunchiest backs.
You were saying that before we went, we had to go to the reverse tanner to get some of our outdoorsiness sucked out of our skin.
Totally.
And I did feel like over tanned to be there. And I'm not that.
No, you're not tan.
I'm not tan. I just,
to me, you look.
I know, like a guy who's been out in the sun.
Suspiciously like a reader.
Yeah. Yeah. But nothing compared to the translucent hordes that we saw at this hotel.
And the thing that made me the saddest, though, is that I never got to experience the toast room.
We tried. We went a couple times, but it was always
too packed
or closed.
It was a room of all toast. You can get any toast you want.
Lots of toast. You could get
cinnamon toast.
Cinnamon toast. You could get sushi on toast. They would give you sushi on toast.
Yeah, I was very sad about that.
Yeah, I know.
So I went home and made toast.
Did you? Yeah.
But I didn't have any.
I always consoled myself with the rice. You could get free rice there. I liked the free rice quite a bit.
And PB&J, I didn't have any of that. No. I didn't experience any of that.
The free lattes, those are pretty good.
I sucked up the coffee like it was.
Yeah, lots of coffee, lots of diet.
Who ever gets to have endless lattes? It's like.
How many did you have?
I had like seven. Seven lattes.
I just had the two. But I had lots of coffee. I would go there and skip the line and just pull up some coffee.
And then I was like, standing in line and be irritated that it wasn't going faster. Like, I had to remind myself, you're not going to Dumb Brothers. These are all amateurs.
Yeah.
Come on!
Yeah,
because I used to work in a coffee shop, so I saw how they were doing it. It's like, oh, they're doing it all wrong. not tamping the copyright. That's why your espresso is like half grounds and half.
Yeah, yeah.
But
actually, it wasn't half grounds. That was like a centimeter deep lake sludge of fudge.
A fudge.
It was a mocha.
And if I would have known things beforehand, I would have liked to have participated in one of those where you beat each other with the...
The foam swords and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that would have made it fun. And then you can meet people and feel a part of something. Yeah. But yeah. I felt like it was on the fringe of a fringe society.
Yeah.
Which is not a good place for me.
Well, one of the things that I was aiming to do and going to this is to see, you know, just to sort of dip my toe in, see if this is kind of something that I would enjoy.
Right.
And to sort of like, you know, learn what the script is. You know,
yeah, it's like, rules, like, yeah, what are the rules? Cultural meme.
Yeah. And I kind of get it now. The ideal way to do it is to go there and have a room, like either there in the hotel or ideally like across the street. I'm thinking would be the better place to stay.
I don't think that would be ideal. I think in the hotel would be ideal.
Really?
Yeah.
Just so that when the evening's festivities really get rolling, you don't have to get into a car and try to drive. I think that's when the big fun starts.
If I go next year, I want to get a t-shirt that says Secret Nerd.
Secret Nerd.
Or yeah. Undercover Nerd.
Undercover. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. It's all about the t-shirts.
Well, and I got hit on by an old corset maker in a kilt who writes gay male erotica. So
and his wife
wrestle him.
And his wife lets him.
And his wife lets him. That was the highlight of my evening, of my day.
Yes, indeed.
It's a good story, at least.
Yeah. And we actually, when we went to
I a, didn't wrestle.
No, we didn't wrestle. No. We went to a podcasting seminar. We learned that we're actually doing a pretty good job.
We're doing okay. We could do better, but they didn't have anything more to tell us than that we already knew.
Not really. They have some websites that we should check out, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But we got to meet other podcasters, and we were supremely gratified to actually be recognized, albeit dimly, by one of the panelists.
Who's a good podcaster. So shout out to Commander Tim.
There it is.
He has a good podcast.
He's a good podcast. What is the book we're reading? Well,
let's call The Shadow at the Bottom of the World by Tom Ligotti. Thomas Ligotti.
Yes. I got you a copy of this book thinking that we could podcast on this and that it would be, you know, Thomas Ligotti's books they come into print and they go out of print relatively quickly.
This is going to be really hard to talk about.
No, it's not.
I cannot think of a way to talk about these books. Short stories are hard to talk about.
We will find a way. You watch.
I've been fretting about this all day.
Have you really? Have you been wringing your hands? And going,
I have been pacing and I threw up a couple of times.
You threw up a couple of times?
Yeah.
Have you been worrying the bottom of your t-shirt? What are we going to do?
That's freaking me out. Okay. Stop doing that.
It's freaking me out a little bit too. But no, I picked this book. I selected this particular edition of Thomas Ligotti because he's got a lot of books out, but they're hard to find. And I thought this one was going to be pretty easy to find because it was printed in 2005, you know, 3 years ago. How hard can it be? Well, this stupid book is out of print and it's immediately become a collector's item again, so it's kind of hard to find. And so if anybody
out there... No, I have it.
Anybody out there...
If everybody wants to buy this book for $300, I'll sell it.
Do not...
There's no lines in it or anything.
So if anybody out there is trying to find this book and are having a hard time finding it for less than $30, I'm sorry. So, what did you think? Did you enjoy any of these stories?
Enjoy the stories.
Yeah.
I did. I enjoyed them. I didn't enjoy all of them because some of them felt like they were half written. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it seemed like he just like threw some shit on a page and then published it. And
that actually may be fair.
I think it is fair. I think it's as fair as it could be. It took sort of a mind shift for me,
very much so,
to slow down.
Yeah, these stories, you have to really, it's almost like reading poetry.
But if you read fast, you miss everything.
Yeah, you miss everything because every sentence really matters. You can't just like...
And short stories are short.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the longest one in here is maybe, what, 25, 30 pages?
Yeah, if that.
But this collection, The Shadow at the Bottom of the World, is sort of spans his career. His first, one of his earliest published stories, The Last Feast of the Harlequin.
An homage to somebody.
Lovecraft, for sure. Yeah.
Were you reading Wikipedia?
No. I actually recognized it.
Actually, he said that.
Oh, really? Does he? Yeah. Well, specifically, it harkens back to a Lovecraft story called The Festival.
It's
a short story about this this town that has this weird festival that goes on that involves people going underground to witness some horrible, you know, thing with creatures and so this story, Last Feast of the Harlequin, is actually better than the Lovecraft stories. Actually, all of this may be blasphemy to anybody who cares, but Ligotti is way better of a writer than Lovecraft. Way better. In almost every way. Did you read the... there's a little preface here, which is an excerpt from a book of criticism that Ligotti's doing that hasn't been published yet, I guess.
Didn't read it.
You didn't read it?
No.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I will read it now.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. Mr.
Pause.
Okay,
we're back.
We're back. It's half an hour later. And I read it a couple times. Well, twice. Well, at the very beginning and then again last night. But there's a couple of lines in here where he's trying to wrestle with what makes horror horrible, which is something that we wrestle with all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, so here's the first line. He just lays it out at the beginning here. I thought this was fantastic. For a horror story to be effective, it must both reflect and deform the world we know. So the story has to be familiar to the world that we know.
But unnatural.
But it has to be deformed. It has to be twisted and broken or mangled in some way so that it's not quite the world. Yes. So that first story, The Last Feast of the Harlequin, it starts as mundane as possible. And actually, I responded to it quite... I responded to it a lot because it's about an academic who is, you know, wrapped up in the world of academic publishing. He's, you know, researching an article for a journal, and he's in the clowns. He's a clown. He studies clowns, and his research leads him down these paths that of knowledge that he shouldn't know.
I felt bad for him because he's all getting his all his clown stuff.
I know.
And his makeup, he's all excited. I'm going to go to this town. I can like blend with all the other clowns. And
it was very much like going to a convention.
Yeah, I felt sad. It really was. And he got there. It's like, oh, this isn't like the clown world I was expecting.
Yeah, well, he was expecting the clown to be, you know, like the kind of festive clown. But in this town that he goes to, the clowns are... They're kind of like
getting psychopomps.
Yeah, well, they're like getting the big black dot on the paper in Shirley Jackson's Lottery. They are the victim. They're the ones who are sacrificed. Well, they don't get sacrificed. They get abused and not in a friendly way.
They're like the scapegoats.
Yeah, the scapegoats. So he sort of steps in that and then he, you know, gets some abuse.
I think the only problem I had with these stories is you kind of knew where they were going.
Kind of.
I think I mostly knew where they were going. There's going to be a clown sacrifice, and they're going to get somebody virgin because it's a festival, and they always kill a virgin at a festival. Yeah.
It did reflect that, but it kind of deformed it as well.
It deformed it, and you know, it was also about his disappointment.
Yeah. but the festival,
sort of the dark world he enters.
And, yeah. What I want to find is here. He says it explicitly in his introduction that he finds very cheap and disappointing the kind of horror that relies on playing with people's religious beliefs. Basically, The Exorcist. He thinks that that kind of horror is it's cheap. I don't know if I agree with
him. I don't agree with him at all.
I kind of.
I think cheap horror is the slashing horror.
Yeah, that's
cheap.
That's horror. As cheap as it gets.
And the torture horror and the eviscerating horror. Yeah. That's cheap.
Yeah,
horror.
Just the gore horror. Gore. I mean, it's horrible, but it's cheap. It's easy. It's something you can resort to if you need to, you know. But above that, I think there's the kind of horror that does resort to exploiting people's, religious upbringings, basically. The Exorcist is very effective. It was very effective to me as a 14-year-old when I first saw it, having been raised Catholic. Very effective. Slept with the rosary for I don't know how many nights after I saw that movie. But the hardest kind of horror, I'm kind of cribbing some comments that Stephen King wrote. I can't even remember where he wrote these about the levels of horror, is to, without going for gore, without going for religious horror, is to sort of unsettle the reader in. I'm having a hard time explaining this. I think Ligotti does it better when he just says, by showing you the world and twisting it slightly, making it seem as though you are in a waking nightmare, where things are out of your control, where you see the world in a new way, in a new horrible way. Ligotti sometimes actually is able to do that for me when I read it, when I read his stories. Confession time, I'm a big fan of Thomas Ligotti. I have been for quite some time. I haven't read him in a while, though.
I think sometimes he did it. I think for me, sometimes, I mean, his writing style is kind of murky.
Yeah.
And you don't always really know what's happening, which is sort of in the line of Lovecraft and how I understand Lovecraft.
Yeah.
So this space is missing that you have to kind of fill in.
Yeah.
I didn't always feel unsettled, but I did sometimes feel unsettled.
Yeah.
I think some things were not. Some things seemed more like exercises that he was writing, so I didn't.
Sort of. I mean, that is a.
For you, sort of. For me, not sort of. Some things seemed like he was doing a writing exercise. Yeah.
There was one story that just left me completely cold. It was an early one. It's like Mr. Veach and Dr. something or other.
Oh, see.
Dr. Volk and Mr. Veach.
No, I really liked that
story. Did you like that story?
Yes.
I just read that and I'm like, ah.
That creeped me out. I liked that story. I wasn't quite sure. You weren't quite sure of the person's motives. Mm-hmm. You weren't quite sure what exactly happened fully. But yeah, I liked that story because there was a weird death in it, and there was bleeding puppets. And
well, bleeding puppets is... Yeah.
And there's a contract of some sort. Yeah, I enjoyed that story a lot. And it was murky. And I wrote down something. My favorite line of his was something about the greasy red light, which I thought was great.
His descriptions are pretty great.
They can be, yeah.
They can be. You said, I talked to you, we try not to discuss the books that we're reading until...
Even though I don't usually want to.
Yeah, until the microphone is on and the tape is rolling. But you did say that you had read the story Purity, the last one in the collection, and the only new one. This is the only place that Purity has appeared so far as I know.
That was a good story.
That was a great story, as far as I'm concerned.
I really liked that story.
Because it cut.
That was the best story in the book.
I agree. Because for me, it was because it was describing a perfectly common situation, just family life, and like living in a neighborhood, hanging out with the neighbors, and that's exactly what life is like for our narrator. He's just a young boy, like a teenager maybe.
He's a teen.
And his dad is kind of goofy. He spends a lot of time in the basement. Mom and sister are frequently go on sabbatical, which may or may not be prostitution, or you don't know.
You don't know what it is.
You don't know what it is.
I think they're like selling parts or something.
That could be. And they live in a crummy neighborhood. They move from house to house because they kind of wear the houses out, or they can't pay the rent or something.
Because the dad's investigating this idea of horror, a Of a haunting.
Of haunting, yeah.
So he wants to go to different houses.
And yeah. Yeah. Because his theory is that the haunting... haunting only exists
in the mind.
In the mind of the person experiencing the haunting. And he has this device to draw the haunting, draw the that part of the mind out. And it's very weird, and I mean it's told in such a plain style. It's just like, you know, you're living in your neighborhood and hanging out with mom and dad, and you know, it's very 16 candles. Except that everything is above, you know, a half a bubble off level. And it's really effective.
Yeah.
Because, and it ends
well, and his whole thing is about that there's three, like, there's three things to be.
Yeah, his father.
That says, make things.
Three things that matter in the world.
That, and make things impure in a way. You know, religious ideas.
Yeah, there's country, the idea of country,
the idea.
And nationalism, religion.
And then, no, that's it. It's just those two.
Well, then at the end it says it's the third one.
But that's not that. That's the kid discovers that. They're sort of like these interjections that become sort of idols to people and mess with people's minds and how they think. You know, religion and country, God and country.
Yeah.
And then the kid discovers, oh, it's God, country, and family.
Family. Well, his mom tells him that. It's just blowing smoke in his face.
Yeah.
And I thought that story was terrific. Just terrific. Mm-hmm. Thomas Ligotti
it was clear, too.
Yeah.
It was a clear story.
It was clear.
Didn't seem like a writing exercise. It seemed...
But one of the things I kind of want to touch on as we talk about all these stories is something that he actually makes explicit in his introduction, in that he thinks that the inspiration that he thinks it makes for the best horror story, and therefore, he doesn't say this explicitly, but it must be how he puts his stories together, is he uses nightmare logic.
That would make sense.
It makes a lot of sense, yeah. Because his stories, they go from one thing to the next, but the plotting isn't as tight as you would expect, like a story that is just telling what happened. It moves by nightmare logic, so things just kind of glide from one scene to the next sometimes, and you're not quite sure how they got there, or they seem tenuously connected, or if they're connected in some plotted way, you can't understand. It doesn't make logical sense, but it might make nightmare sense.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And
that's like that Mr. Beach and...
Yeah.
That was, everything is by angles, and you're like, well, why is this happening?
Yeah.
Who's this happening to?
Yeah.
And you think, oh, it doesn't really matter. It's just happening.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I don't remember many of my dreams or nightmares, and, but when you wake from them, and if you do remember them, they do kind of plot out, you know, but eventually, inevitably, you have to just say it's like, and then suddenly I was, in the street, walking to
God. They only plot out because when you wake up, your mind is trying to create, connecting to it. But when you're in it, it's not plotting out.
No.
This is only, it's just afterwards.
Yeah.
And the more telling you do of it, the more you're creating a story.
Yeah, yeah. So the some of the images in that last story, Purity, visiting that house, the neighbor house with what was her name? The woman who was always sitting there watching TV, who wanted him to go and buy her salami sticks.
Yeah,
I mean, just the idea of this woman who's sitting there watching TV.
She's a squatter.
She's a squatter, just like they are, more or less. And he asks to use the bathroom, so she says, "Go upstairs and don't fall in." Like, ha ha, don't fall in. Literally, the bathroom is a hole in the floor, which drops down, I'm guessing, two stories into the basement, and there's all this human waste and rats down there.
Yeah. And a couch or something.
And a couch, and then eventually some bodies.
Yeah.
I was like, that is so creepy, but so mundane. It's just tenement living, but the way he writes it is like, this is like a nightmare house.
Yeah. Though the kid... Doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
He's not that disturbed by it.
Yeah, that's just his life. That's his family, his neighborhood. So I thought that last story I thought was fantastic. Now, Thomas Ligotti, in the early 90s, was kind of writing in a white heat. He put out 3 books of short stories in pretty quick succession, but he slowed way down since then. And it kind of bums me out because clearly he has learned his craft. I mean, he started out pretty good in my book, but he's getting really good now, and you should write more.
You should write him and ask him.
I should write him and ask him. Thomas Ligotti, he's still alive. He's very reclusive. I've never seen a picture of him.
I went on the Google Images to find pictures.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't tell if it's the Thomas Ligotti that we're talking about or not.
Yeah, maybe not. He was in Florida, apparently. He, like me, works in the publishing industry. He was a copy editor and a book editor. And was in Michigan for a while. That's when he was doing most of his writing. And he's gone freelance, so he's just a freelance editor now. Yeah, I deal with these people all the time. And most of the freelance editors I deal with are either independent scholars, which means that they're people with PhDs who, for one reason or another, have been unable to locate a tenure-track job somewhere. Or they're writers. Thomas Ligotti is a writer. So... I found this out as I started reading this particular volume, and so I was, this is no fair. Thomas Ligotti, if you're reading this, if you're listening to this, and why would you be? just ignore what I'm about to say. This book needed to be better proofread. I mean, it was pretty clean compared to some of the other books that we've gotten, especially ones from Small Press.
Well,
the press, Cold Spring Press. I mean, it's distributed by Simon & Schuster, but Simon & Schuster,
looks like a vanity press.
Yeah, they just put it in the catalog. Yeah. They don't take care, they don't supply any of the production work on it. And so, I mean, it's pretty clean. Clearly, the author has gone through and cleaned up these stories. A lot of these stories have been published 4 or 5 times. In various books and collections and stuff like that. But there's a couple I was like, ooh, here's a glaring.
Well, you know what they really goof up is at the end of, at least in my copy, that they have, you know how they'll have the short story.
Yeah, the running name. The running heads are messed up in the last story.
Right, and you're like, what?
I know.
They're telling the same story again? What the hell?
I know, yeah. On the verso page, it has the name of the book, and on the retro page, it has the name of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Except in the last story, it's the name of the book, Recto and Verso.
It's a dream. It's a nightmare book.
There's no logic to how they did that.
It's just words just pop up where words want to pop up. What other stories did you like?
I just love that last story. I liked Teatro Grotesco, about this artist colony that is slowly getting picked off one by one by this guerrilla theater group.
Which I think they're making a movie of that story.
Of Teatro Grotesco?
Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Why? I hadn't run across that.
I think it's either a movie or that Ligotti's writing a longer story or a book about it.
Yeah, that idea seemed kind of rich. You know, there's that, I don't know if you, you read Boing Boing, and I'm sure many of our listeners do as well.
If you don't, go to boingboing.com.
Yeah.
Or boingboingtv.com.
Or boingboing gadgets.
Paid for you by Boing Boing.
Yeah, man.
Give us some money, Boing Boing. famous Boing Boing.
Once in a while, Boing Boing will cover the latest theatrical intervention by this theater group called, I think it's called Theater Everywhere.
Theatrical Intervention?
Yeah, where you've seen these people where they're like, the latest one was they had gotten a bunch of identical twins together.
I saw that.
And they dressed them the same, and they put them on a subway car.
I think it's funny that you call it an intervention.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I work with academics. Academics stage interventions. They're intervening into the workaday world, or when they got, I don't know, like 100 people.
It sounds blowhardy to me.
Yeah, it is blowhardy. We host a podcast. We're blowhards. Cop to it. where they had 50 to 100 people in Grand Central Station, and at the stroke of like 3 p.m. or like 5 p.m. whatever time it was, they all like froze.
Yeah, that's called flash something.
Yeah, just
flash mob. It's called a flash mob.
Yeah, or guerrilla theater. Teatro, in the story of Teatro Grotesco, it's much more sinister, where they intervene in these artists' lives in such a way that it ends their artistic life.
Right.
They stop writing. They work as fry cooks or accountants for the rest of their lives. And I wonder if there was a little bit of autobiographical or just like sort of a nightmare that author Tom Segatti had, because he was very prolific and then he kind of slowed down and nearly stopped. I mean, instead of writing out 5 or 6 stories a year, he's down to like 1 or 2, if that.
Well, yeah. Maybe the more you expect out of yourself, the less you're creative.
Yeah.
And the less the muses want to help you.
Yeah, exactly.
He also writes about that writer in his first story. Is it the first story? The one about the children's writer? That's not the first story. Alice's Last Adventure.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Which, it's also about writing and how the world gets kind of, how the world that she's creating kind of twists back on her.
Yeah.
And takes her, basically.
Yeah.
And, that's also probably...
Yeah,
what happens? You know,
I mean, I said earlier that Thomas Ligotti is reclusive. He's not a recluse. I mean, he does give grant interviews, and he collaborates. There's I was looking for this the other day at the local comic store. There's a collection, a graphic novel, which is a illustrated versions of some of these stories, called Nightmare Factory, something like that.
Oh yeah. I saw an ad for that.
That's in print.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, so I was looking for it. I couldn't find it at the local shop, so I think I'll just order it online. But yeah, he does produce work. He collaborates. He works with some industrial noise band called Current 93, and has produced some short story musical compositions, which I've never listened to them. I'm sure they're very cool. He is active, and I think he's not hiding or anything like that. He's not Thomas Pynchon, but prefers his privacy.
Well, he's not like a Stephen King.
Well, Stephen King has pretty high visibility.
Right. He's not like a Stephen King.
No, he's definitely not. No.
And he doesn't write novels, really.
He doesn't.
And he says he prefers short stories from what I read. So.
Yeah.
I don't think short stories sell the same way as novels.
They just don't. Yeah.
It's not like a Dean Koontz or
And honestly, tried to write a novel with the density of style that he writes his short stories, I don't know that I could read it. It would be exhausting.
Yeah, you'd have to change the style.
Yeah, you'd have to loosen it up, and every once in a while,
you have to have characters.
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, the characters in these stories, you can find out something about them, but
not a lot.
But not a lot. They're mostly just like ciphers.
Which is really in the right, isn't it? That in the vein of Lovecraft himself,
or
Liber, or Poe.
Yeah, I mean, how much do we know about in the Casper Amontillado, about Fortunato, the victim, or Montresor? You know that Montresor is really pissed off at Fortunato. And that's about it. That's just about it.
How much do you know about the Black Cat? Or the Raven?
Or the Raven.
You don't know anything about the Raven. The cawing and the pooping on the books in the library.
And perching on the bust of Palace.
I enjoyed that else. And at first I was trying to find, maybe he's writing... Because I thought the first 3 stories seemed to have corollaries into other stories. Because Alice, definitely Alice in Wonderland, he brings it up a lot in the story. And there's mirrors and things turning in on themselves and that. Like, okay. And then the Harlequins. Okay, the Harlequin's a Harlequin. And that's the story of the Harlequin, the clown. And then there was another one. There was the puppets. So it's like the weird kind of Pinocchio thing or whatever. Or
crazy Punching Judy.
Going on. And then it's like, okay, let's see if, he keeps this going. He didn't.
No. No. But some of the stories are so out there, like the story of the cocoons.
That's the one story I didn't read.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't read it.
It was very strange. Or the title story, The Shadow at the Bottom.
I just sort of gave up.
Really?
Yeah, that's why I went to the back of the book and read in. It's like, you know what? I'm done reading Tom Segatti for right now.
It's exhausting.
But I did like the Shadow at the Bottom of the World a lot.
That was a good story.
His description of the scarecrow,
yeah,
and how it was moving, how people were describing how it was moving, mm-hmm. I loved it.
Yeah,
I could see it. He painted it so well,
and then finding the scary thing that was growing up through it, that was rooted, and then trying to unroot it, and then finding that hole underneath it that when they drop something in, they could not hear anything hit, and it was like this, you know, they discovered some like world evil.
It reminded me kind of like a Cthulhu thing or something.
Yeah,
right. Like there's this,
yeah.
What I didn't understand is, you know, there was flashing, and again, it's that thing where you're not quite sure what is happening. You're kind of looking through this gauzy,
yeah,
thing where there's a knife, and somebody's going to get stabbed. These two people are going to get stabbed. It's almost like, was this thing asking for a sacrifice?
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy, instead of killing them, kills himself.
Yeah,
to sacrifice himself, yeah, to end this horror.
Yeah, I mean. The way that these stories have their effect, and maybe it's part of the reason that you kind of got exhausted. I mean, you have to labor to get through these stories. They're not easy to read. I mean, all the words are easy enough to understand. Although once in a while he'll pull out a nice old arcane word, which is, I think, it's so tasty. But the logic by which they proceed, just, it takes such an effort to see how one sentence leads to the next.
Because it kind of doesn't. Because it's kind of random. It's just kind of like, okay, now we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So, and you're like, well, is that sloppy or is that
genius? And I think it's
genius.
I think it's very much not sloppy.
Being fooled that way.
You're not being fooled. You're being disoriented.
Well, that's fine.
And being disoriented all the time is exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another
reason. Your mind trying to make sense of things all the time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
That's why I got done with him.
Yeah, so I would read a story. You know, sometimes when I read books with short stories, and I don't do it a lot anymore, but I'll, you know, finish a short story, close the book for a second, scratch my nose, crack the book again, and go on to the next story.
Yeah, you couldn't do that with that.
With this. You would, I was good for a story a day. Maybe every other day.
I have to say, I found it enjoyable in a strange way,
mm-hmm.
but it wouldn't be something I would want to do often.
Mm-mm.
You know, because I like my horror cheap and trashy.
Yeah.
And easy.
This is.
And freewheeling easy. Yeah. Freeballing horror. That's what I want.
And this is not. This is very literary. I want to mention a writer that reminds me more than any other writer, even more than Poe and Lovecraft, and that's Kafka. Kafka short stories
mm-hmm.
are very similar, where they kind of move by dream logic. Like, a guy wakes up, he's a cockroach.
Even Kafka's novels move that way.
Yeah. Yeah, where they, scene, how are these connected? You know, and sometimes they're not connected. I mean, those novels, The Castle and The Trial, the arrangement of the chapters is arbitrary. They're not sure if that's how Kafka wanted to put them together.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, you know. I think Kafka's a major inspiration.
You really have to sort of give over your linear mind.
Yeah.
And just say, I'm just going to read the images.
Yeah.
I'm just going to participate in this.
Yeah. And if you do give it over, that I think is what he's hoping for.
Because Mr. What's his face and who's he? What's it? Mr. Volk and Mr. Beach.
And Dr. Beach. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to read. That was the only story I read twice.
Mm-hmm.
I read through and I'm like, boy, I just like breezed through that like I'm reading People magazine.
Yeah.
Then I went back and I enjoyed it. I slowed it down. Really?
Yeah.
Just trying to put myself into it.
Yeah.
And it was a very creepy story. Yeah.
These are stories that are meant to be reread. You have to get to that first reading, make what sense you can, and then go back. Now, I've read, I have those first three short story books, The Songs of the Dead Dreamer, Grim Scribe, and Noctuary. And I read, I got them as they came out back in the early 90s and mid 90s. And so all these stories, with the exception of the last three or four, are in those books. And so I have reread all these stories. I mean, it's been a long time. But I remembered parts of them. And so when I was rereading these all, they really had an effect.
What kind of effect?
Kind of, well, like I was saying, it was disorienting in an aesthetic way.
Mm-hmm. Is that a pleasant experience for you?
It was a very pleasant experience. I like those kind of experimental, like goofy, like crazy experimental film. I like Guy Madden movies or Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where it works by dream logic, and I like just like watching something or experiencing something and not having to make sense of what happens next. Figure out who the killer is, look for the surprise or anything like that. These things, there's no surprises. There's no killer. It's just the characters sort of get taken apart slowly. Their minds sort of get slowly taken apart. And that's kind of the process that, in a much diminished way, that Ligotti's stories has on the reader. It kind of pulls you apart a little bit. Makes you uneasy in your being in the world in a tiny little bit.
At least for that moment.
I don't know if it makes
me uneasy for being in the world, but story.
But just for that moment.
It doesn't make me look at the world any differently.
Yeah, that's why I say these are like very aesthetic horror stories. They're not page turners by any means.
No.
There's something to be savored. You put them on the shelf and you pull them off once in a while and you read a story. You don't read the whole book. You just read a story.
But strangely, I think his stories would make good movies.
You know, there has been a movie.
Because you're not really in people's heads in these books.
Yeah.
You're really not. You're watching things happen and you're hearing things.
Yeah.
But you're not hearing a lot of people's thoughts. Which is always like why a lot of Stephen King's books don't really work as movies, because a lot of his books are in people's heads.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a movie. His visual imagery and stuff would make good movies.
Yeah. Like, there has been a movie made of one of his stories. It's not in this book. It's called The Frolic. It's one of his most popular stories about, if I can remember correctly, it's been 10 years since I read this story, about a guy who sort of... gets taken apart, more or less, and finds his inner joy, his frolic, which is, you are led to believe, is a remarkably violent thing. We're not told exactly what the frolic is, but at the end, he begins his frolic, and you're supposed to be chilled, and it's pretty chilling.
Mm.
Mostly because you don't know precisely what that means.
You have to think of what it would be.
Yeah.
Creepiest.
Yeah.
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 Pretty remarkable.
So,
did you notice that there's two things he really likes? Puppets. And cities.
Cities and towns.
Well, more than towns. Cities, because he has stories that are just about cities,
yeah,
and people going into cities and people dreaming about cities, and he likes something about the city. They're usually decaying cities,
yeah,
and then puppets. There, he mentions the word puppet probably in every story.
Yes,
I don't think I'm kidding. Yeah, which are just big puppets.
Yeah,
but he talks about puppets or being a puppet.
Yeah.
And,
there's something very Freudian in that. It's something very uncanny.
Even know if it's Freudian, because he talks... I mean, it's not unconscious, I guess that's what I thought you meant. But he even talked about... Where did I read this? Was it in this book? He talked about the puppet. Yeah. Well, that story that introduces the puppet, that it's wood that gets...
Animated. It's animated in an inanimate object. That's very uncanny.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's...
And that we're all puppets is basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
Is that we're puppets of something.
Yeah, yeah, there's a deep philosophical thing going through all of these stories.
Well, he's really pissed off about something.
Well, One of the things, you know, like I said, he's reclusive but not reckless. He has given interviews and stuff like that, and he has explained that, you know, he has suffered in the past, and possibly still does, from anxiety. Like, he has an anxiety disorder. So I think he is in touch with you know, like, everyday fears that, you know, that other people are able to just more or less quash, ignore, or not experience.
Yeah, the veil is very thin for him.
The veil is very thin for him.
He's also things I work about him is called the nihilist, which he would say is not a word you would use, a person uses to describe themselves. It's the word that people use to describe other people.
Yeah.
But his idea that, you know, this is all nonsense,
yeah,
and what you have to do is create art to get through it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that comes even through.
Even art, which in itself is meaningless. I mean, you can sit on these stories and that's what he says in the introduction, in so many words. You make these temporary, ultimately ineffectual.
But that's different than it being meaningless, if it's ineffectual.
If you're trying to make meaning and it turns out to be meaningless, it's ineffectual.
I totally disagree with you.
All right.
I think that's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. Because it's the act of making meaning, which what he's saying is it's like, you know, trying to drain the ocean by the spoonful.
Yeah,
you know, it just can't be done. It's just too big and wide.
What if there's a really, really big spoon?
But still, still can't do it. You do what you can. It's very Camus. It's very,
yeah.
You do what you can, and even so, it's ineffectual only in the huge universal sense.
Yeah.
Of the word.
Yeah.
But not. He wouldn't do it if it was ineffectual.
He does it because
it affects him.
There's no other choice.
Of course there's other choices. The other choice is to do nothing. There is another choice.
That's true.
So that's baloney. That's all just a bunch of...
you should shoot him an email about that. He'll figure that. He needs to know that. No, he said it's something he says in the introduction.
Yeah, but you know what? He's writing an introduction as an author,
yeah,
who is... I mean, that's all meta...
Yeah.
Gobbledygook. I mean, I just can't buy it. You can say crap. So, but if you do it, it's just like that. A while ago, when you and I and the other guy read that book about those small practices.
Oh, the French. Dress or toe.
Yes.
But the practice of everyday life.
Yes.
Falling more.
Right.
Mm hmm.
I'm not gonna say anything more.
that right there was way more pedantic than anything I've ever said on this podcast ever.
Pedantic. What do you mean?
He just referenced Dester Toe. You're gonna bring in a whole new.
Hey, we read that damn thing. We gotta make use of it. That book. Not that I can remember everything we read, but the idea of what we read,
mm-hmm,
has stuck with me.
I know.
Like nothing.
And
I'll see people doing something, I'll go, oh, small practices.
Yeah.
I'll see a path.
Yeah.
Well, there shouldn't be a path, or I'll think of something I'll do to be a little instigator.
Tactics against the strategy.
Yeah. It's like, oh. And it really fits with the way I do therapy. But yeah, that book has...
I know.
That...
I think about it quite often.
That's why I think Ligotti's full of shit when he even says that. Because even the act of saying that, saying those things and coming up with those things.
But isn't that
if it's in the large picture of things? Yes, I mean the world is the world and the universe.
Yeah.
The wave that's going to come at you is going to come.
See what?
But why do anything that?
I'm hearing you talk about this, and I can't find you disagreeing with me.
I am disagreeing with you. I'm disagreeing with you, and I don't know if we have the exact phraseology. Is that it's ultimately ineffectual?
Yes.
Well, that's what I think is bullshit, because it depends what level you're working on. So
yes.
In Thomas Ligotti's day-to-day life, mm-hmm. it's not ineffectual.
No.
It gives him a purpose.
No.
It gives him something to do with his right hand other than beat off. It gives him, you know, it's effectual that way.
Yeah.
And he's got people who want to know about him.
Yeah.
Look, every artist has an ego.
Yeah.
So his ego is getting... come on. Now, in the grand scheme, can he stop the gods from sucking the life force out of us and turning us all to dust? No.
Yeah.
But what can?
Right there, we just agreed. Yeah, that's the level I'm talking about.
No, you weren't.
Yes, I was.
You were not. You were not.
It's the
you
same
just
thing.
Switched.
It's the same thing with Samuel Beckett, who's another one of my favorite writers, who doesn't belong in this podcast.
But that's the absurdist philosophy. That's the existential philosophy, is that, you know, you do whistle in the wind. You know, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And that
whistling does nothing.
That's not true. It does do something. It doesn't stop the wind from blowing, but it does something for the whistler.
Yes.
And that is a something.
For a little while.
Well, for as ever long as
until the reality.
No, well, the reality, there is no reality. The reality is what you look at.
Yeah.
So, and then if you do, as long as you're going to go on living, this is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you do see the
reality.
If you do see the reality, then you have to change your tune.
Yep.
Because if not, then you kill yourself. And that's what people do.
That's what people do.
So, sit there and eat fish and chips and watch TV all day and don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But even
or salami sticks.
Even that is something.
Yeah.
You know? So, I disagree with you.
I agree that you disagree with me.
But you're saying that means nothing, and I don't agree with that.
Ultimately.
It doesn't. What does that even mean, ultimately? That's just a word.
No, you're
ultimately
talking...
Ultimately what?
You're talking about... it's making my head hurt.
You brought it up, so you have to defend it. Ultimately what?
Ultimately anything... Anything... These little artistic productions are just temporary stays against the final meaninglessness.
All right. And
you disagreed with me.
No. So what?
That was it.
What does ultimately, that mean? Who decides what? Who's going to decide what that is? Ultimately,
there's no decider.
Yeah. So you can't even decide what's ultimate.
Nobody can.
Right. So then, what do you have to do?
If there's no decider, where's the meaning?
The meaning comes with the person in the moment.
Where's the transcendent meaning?
That's the ultimate moment. The ultimate meaning is in the moment, in
particulars.
The particular is in the moment. The ultimate is in...
I'll buy that. That's how I live my life. That's how everybody lives their lives.
No, not everybody, no.
Well, if they...
No, if you're anxious... No, you're either in the past or you're in the future. and most of the world lives in the past or in the future.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So that's how our brain that's how our brain is constructed. It's the people who can live in the present, not like be merry and then tomorrow we die. Not that kind of present.
No.
But being in this moment, those are the people who are, well, those are gods, you know? Those are Buddhas. Not very many people can do that for a sustained... It's hard to do. It's small practices.
Small practices gets to be...
So Thomas Ligotti is full of shit. He's just saying stuff just to say stuff. He is. I think. Because ultimately, why would he do it then? Why doesn't he just kill himself?
Cover your ears, Tom. Don't do that.
Well, of course not.
Because
it goes back to Loga... You know, you read Man's Search for Meaning?
No.
Oh, you should. By Viktor Frankl?
Yeah, I haven't read that.
Oh, you should read that. I mean, it's seminal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically what he comes up with is that people make their own meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the people in the concentration camps who just died
mm-hmm.
are the ones who gave up trying to make meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they just
dithered
and withered away.
Yeah.
And he knew his wife was dead, and yet... He knew she was dead. He knew she was killed and went up in ashes. But he made a meaning that she was there, and every day he put her face in front of him, and he survived, and he went on to help a lot of people. And ultimately, is that meaningless? Who's going to decide what that means? Who's going to decide what that ultimate is? Ultimately, according to who?
We have never cut off this big of a piece of the cookie.
This is the way I think every day. So
really?
Oh, yeah.
I can't think this way every day. Anyway, do we have more to say about this book?
I have so much more to say now that the booze is kicking in. I didn't know what I was going to be talking about.
See, I had no fears that you were going to find something to talk about. None whatsoever.
Oh, so do we agree? We agreed and we disagreed. It's very important.
We agreed and disagreed, depending upon which level of meaning we looked at.
That is good.
Yeah. Yeah, we agreed on all levels of meaning. We just had difficulty finding ourselves on the same level.
I guess you know what it does to me is when I hear people say those things, I think it hits something.
Yeah.
Because I have to work all day with people who are trying to figure out what things mean in a weird way.
Yeah.
And I've seen people kill themselves. Well, I haven't seen it, but I've had people kill themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think, don't go throwing that shit around like that.
Yeah.
Because
it kills people.
Well, it, you know, kills the human spirit or whatever. No, and what if that's all we got?
Yeah,
that's it. That's all we got. This is the human spirit.
That really is all you got.
That's all we got.
Yeah, and I am not about squashing that sort of thing.
I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong to do that.
Yeah,
I think if there's like a morality, that would be the morality to me, probably.
Yeah, don't kill the human spirit.
Don't kill the human. You can kill everything else if you want.
As a carnivore, I'm all for that.
And I don't think that's what Thomas Ligotti is doing, because he wouldn't be writing. Mm-hmm. Because those books do something for the human spirit, you know?
Yeah.
Speaking of nothing in particular, it's cocktail time!
It is cocktail time. So after all that heavy philosophy, I need a drink. Another one.
Totally.
So
I haven't thought of any cocktail.
I have thought of the
cocktail. I was hoping that you would.
I have thought of a cocktail. I call this cocktail, I'll give you the ingredients and then I'll tell you what the
Well, can I guess what the name is after you give the ingredients?
Yeah, guess what the name is. Okay, so this is an up cocktail. What you do is you put in two shots of triple sec, one shot of vanilla vodka, a little splash of cream, you shake it up with ice, and you pour that in a cocktail glass.
You call it the greasy red light?
No.
Oh.
Any other guesses?
The hole at the bottom of the world?
No, it's the bad dreamsicle.
Oh, that sounds good. All right.
Yeah,
it is good too.
Bad dreamsicle.
Bad dreamsicle.
So there it is.
Chin chin. Well, since we don't know what book we want to read, why don't we head down to the vaults of the Forbidden Book Group studio.
All right, let's go.
Let's go. Well, here we are.
Here we are.
Walking through the Forbidden Book Group studio, dank. I always wonder, is it a good idea to put books in a basement vault?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the walls are awfully covered with nitre.
So,
and this is bricked up portion here.
We're in the A section, you know, and we're in the B section. Now, okay, we're in the...
You know, I used to hear knocking behind that bricked up section. But then it went away.
This is like an old light brain that we stuck down here.
Could be.
So we're in the D section, Mike. What are we reading?
Well, here, let's pull this book off here. Thomas Dish. You know, I heard that that Thomas Dish recently passed away.
He had a hard life, apparently.
Well,
maybe. Some bum things happen.
Could be. But he has a local connection. I've always wanted to read I've read some of his science fiction, but never...
He's from Doppeltown?
He is from Doppeltown. Or he has a connection with Doppeltown. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I think he went to school here or something.
Mm.
But He had never read any of his horror novels, so I think we should.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. What's it called?
It is called The MD, A Horror Story.
There you go.
So that's my indication that it's a horror story.
And when was it written?
Science fiction. Well,
Stephen King liked it, apparently.
Well, yeah, Stephen King likes anything anybody pays him to like. That's not fair. He probably likes what he wants to like.
I think of Stephen King as being fairly
91. Scrupulous. This is published in 91.
1991. All right. Yeah, BMD by Thomas Dish.
Now, this one should be.
Thomas Dish.
Yeah, this one should be easy to find.
All right. So, if it's not...
Don't blame me. Blame...
We're sharing a copy. You're going to rip off a page and mail it to me every day until I get the whole book in the mail.
that's what I will do.
So that's the book.
There it is. Thomas Dish.
All right.
So, we've done the cocktail.
Yes. We went down to the vault.
I know.
I still got a little chill. A little dank kind of, chill.
Yeah, I think
you have to put some stick-ups down there.
I think I'm getting a cough. I think we're pretty much... Do you have anything else you want to say about the...
Well, we didn't talk about the story that I really liked, which was called The Spectacles in the Drawer.
Oh.
And...
Well, too bad, because we're almost out of time.
You know, it's a great...
Give us a... The
main thing is just an unscrupulous guy who's messing with this... with this other man, younger man,
mm-hmm.
and who's sort of his mentor... And this kind of shows how mentors can fuck people up.
Yes, they
can. But he basically sort of hypnotizes this guy to believe that if he's wearing these certain spectacles, and if he cuts himself, and he looks into the blood through these spectacles,
mm-hmm.
then he can see a whole world in there.
Oh.
And
yeah, I remember that now.
Right. So he gives the spectacles to the guy, but he doesn't take away the hypnotic suggestion. And basically he finds this guy just...
Cut the flinders.
Cut to shreds.
Yeah.
Which is a cautionary tale about beware of your mentors.
And the people who put you under hypnotic suggestion.
Yes. Well, I don't know how far... I don't know if that's in reality that would work that way.
Nah.
I think the power of a mentor is much... A teacher is much more powerful.
Yeah.
And I think that was a good kick in the groin to teachers.
Yeah.
Ow! It was a very straightforward, creepy,
yeah.
bloody, and the character, the antagonist, if you want to call him that... His absolute, what do you want to call it, lack of empathy mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. it's just chilling. So, yeah. So that was my favorite story, probably next to Purity.
Yeah. So any book collectors out there, if you see a Thomas Ligotti book in a used bookstore, buy it every time. Well, unless it's $300, because some of them are. But if you can get it for less than $5, buy it, because it's worth more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then last thing is I've been watching this series from Britain called Hex.
Oh, yeah.
And I was really excited
mm-hmm.
to watch it because, I don't know, because I like that stuff. And
you're disappointed, aren't you?
It's been a week of disappointment.
Bitterly disappointed.
So all I can say is it's a cross between Rosemary's Baby,
uh-huh.
all right, Charmed, 90210, and Saved by the Bell. Is basically
See, that what doesn't, it is. That doesn't draw me yeah. in at all.
It could have been so much better than it is.
And it's just not.
It's just not. So I don't recommend it. But I am going to finish it since I started it. And yeah. I tend to slog through things.
That's how I do it. Yeah. Although you recommended to me some time ago some series called... it was a graphic novel done on in video form.
Oh, yeah. The Something of Saints.
Broken Saints.
The Broken Saints.
Couldn't finish it.
You couldn't.
Could not finish it. I tried.
It was difficult.
Put me to sleep every time. Made it through the second disc, and that was done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Two discs. If I watch, that's like 3 hours worth. And I was like, I can't spend another minute of my short life on this.
You're making meaning out of your life. Because if your life was meaningless, you would have watched it.
I would have watched it. So true. So very true.
Even if it was temporary meaning... And basically inconsequential, you made some...
And I watched the Fantastic...
And you've watched Four. Some shite.
I have watched some stanking shite. I watched the Fantastic Four Silver Surfer movie last night, which was shite.
Ooh, I totally want to see that movie.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, it was... I don't remember anything that happened in it.
I'm looking forward to the new Batman because it's gotten great reviews.
Oh yeah, I'm all over that. I'm all over that, like white
on rice,
Joker. Yeah. Think I'm good.
Well, so we got everything done. We got on our list, right?
Yep. So let's
chop off its head.
Put the drive a stick to its heart.
Oh yeah, let's drive a stick to its heart first because that's easier.
Yeah,
and then chop off its head.
Yeah. And then fill its mouth with garlic.
Yes. That sounds delicious.
We'll just go and finish our bad musicals.
And make up meaning for ourselves.
Such as it.
Such as it. Who am I, you?
Bye. Stay in your homes. Repeat.